Welcome back to the program. Youth sports is more than just a pastime. It's a multi-billion dollar business that begins in elementary school and continues into a college system, certainly as competitive as anything in the pros. From movies like Hoosiers and Hoop Dreams and Friday Night Lights, our popular culture has come to reflect a youth sports obsession. What was once a gentle diversion for kids is today sometimes the difference between setting the stage for success or failure. We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Mark Hyman. He's a journalist. He's a former writer for Business Week and Sports Business Journal. He's the author of the previous controversial book, Until It Hurts, America's Obsession with Youth Sports and How It Harms Our Kids. And it is my pleasure to welcome him here to talk about his newest work, The Most Expensive Game in Town, The Rising Cost of Youth Sports and the Toll on Today's Families. Mark Hyman, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. I'm really pleased to be on the show.
Good to have you here. One of the things you talk about early on in the book is that any time you have a situation where adults are benefiting economically from something like youth sports, you're setting yourself up for a problem.
Yeah, I think that's the fundamental tension in my book, and I think the reality of youth sports is that there are a lot of adults whose livelihoods depend on kids and parents consuming services. And, you know, that's kind of our consumer culture. You know, more is better, typically, from the perspective of the entrepreneur, the business person, but that's not always the case for the kid.
But when we look at it in the context of the broader consumer culture and other aspects, even of the educational culture today, we certainly see many areas other than sports where, in fact, adults and or corporations are benefiting from things that they get kids to do or not do.
No question. I mean, this is a much broader issue than youth sports. But I think, you know, in some ways, kids in a sports context, kids are much more vulnerable than they would be in other ways.
How so?
Well, you know, I wrote a book. My first book, as you pointed out, was called Until It Hurts, and it was about kids being pushed beyond physical and emotional limits. You know, we tend to sometimes look at kids as miniature adults, and perhaps in some ways they are, but in terms of what they can withstand physically and emotionally, they're certainly not. Let me give you an example. There's a chapter in the book titled Sports Training for Babies, and I'm not kidding. You know, when you and I were children, it was typical for kids to start in sports, you know, organized sports at maybe age 7 or 8. But that's like mid-career now for a child. And I think part of the reason for that, part of the reason that the age of entry has dropped so dramatically is that because it's profitable for companies that are in the business of getting kids started, you know, in some cases, before the age of 1. That's what that chapter is about, you know, companies and entrepreneurs who are doing that.
But is that the be-all and end-all of it? I mean, certainly we see that on the educational side as well with things like Baby Einstein and all the other accoutrements, you know, that are supposedly going to make your kids smarter from the womb on. So we're seeing it in areas other than sports. The other aspect is the way that we're looking at sports today for kids, particularly starting really young, in terms of building a resume that's ultimately going to carry them off to college somewhere.
Boy, I'm loving this show already, because these are issues that are really important to me and themes of my books. Yes, that's absolutely the case. I mean, in our generation, I think, that the rule was, and to some extent still is, that, you know, sports were about recreation, developing a lifelong interest in being active, developing self-confidence, making friends, sportsmanship, those values and life skills that were really easily attainable through sports. But that's, for the most part, that's what it was about. And that's changed a little bit. And I think you see that if you hang out at youth sports fields and you read about that. You know, you occasionally read about the parent who bit the ear off of the youth sports coach. You know, it makes you wonder what's behind that. And I think it reflects this change that we're talking about, which is viewing sports for kids as some kind of career path, as an investment, emotional and financial, that leads to some kind of payoff down the road, you know, be it your child being accepted to a more exclusive college or a college scholarship to play sports, or, you know, in the case of some parents who are really dreaming big, maybe a professional career for their kid.
How much of it has to do with that a lot of the values that come out of youth sports, the sportsmanship, the Spartan kind of mentality, all the things that were traditionally thought to be part of sports, no longer a part of any other aspect of our educational system, and sports in some ways needs to take up the slack?
Well, I agree with that, and I think, you know, sports can still, and oftentimes does still, offer the opportunity to develop those values. And, you know, if you go to your neighborhood rec field, you'll still see those values being taught. And, you know, I'm a great fan of youth sports. I'm an advocate of sports for kids. I've been a commissioner of a local sports league. So, you know, I'm in no way ready to, you know, throw up my hands in terms of youth sports. I think that it's very easy in our culture to be distracted and to lose sight of what the true value of sports for kids is. And the corporate influences, I think, are part of that distracting factor. It's very easy to get caught up in that, through the importance of that $300 bat or that travel trip to, you know, Cooperstown, New York, when the secret and the value may be at your neighborhood rec field with your kid playing with his or her neighbors.
How much has to do with the powerful pop cultural influence of professional sports and the way that filters down?
Well, that is really a big part of it. I write quite a bit about that. You know, years ago, before the inception of ESPN, before we had been inculcated into the 24/7 sports media culture, there was a huge chasm between professional sports that we saw on TV and youth sports that we saw in our neighborhoods, our kids playing. There was never any doubt or problem about distinguishing one from the other. But that distinction, I think, has really been blurred over the years. You know, if you turn on ESPN now, you will see 11- and 12-year-old kids playing sports on national TV, in some cases at 10 o'clock at night. So to some extent, you know, kids sports has become an entertainment product. And that's exactly it. It is a product that is being sold. You know, sponsors are being solicited. Rights fees are being sold. So in some ways, I think we're treating youth sports as we do professional sports, and not surprisingly, some of the less positive influences of youth sports have been transferred to, you know, our attitudes towards sports for kids.
There's also an element of provincialism in that, because one of the things that ESPN has found is that local pride becomes such a powerful issue, and it's part of the reason that they broadcast as much local sports as they do.
Yeah.
There's even a danger in that.
Well, I have a chapter in the book in which I write about ESPN and other major media companies developing kind of a franchise in high school sports and the ways in which that is changing high school sports. And I don't think they're all that evident at first glance, but I think they are significant. Let me give you an example. Both ESPN and USA Today have, and have had for some years, top 20 or 25 polls in a number of different sports. These are national high school polls, so that, you know, if you're playing girls basketball and you're a highly successful team, your aspiration may be to be one of those 25 teams recognized by USA Today as one of the top in the country. So that seems like a fairly benign enterprise, but I'm not so sure, let me give you an example. There is a team, a boys basketball team in Houston from a high school called Yates. And in 2010, they were a demolition squad. They were winning games routinely by 50 or more points. One game, they were leading at the half 100-12. Now, why would a team and why would a coach have an interest in being ahead by 88 points at the half? And I don't think it takes a lot of analysis. I mean, this team was climbing the rankings, climbing the USA rankings each week against other teams that were undefeated around the country. So the only way to distinguish themselves from those other undefeated teams was to win by these absurd margins. Eventually, Yates won the USA Today top 25 poll. They finished number one, but at the expense of a lot of important values, sportsmanship being number one.
What are we seeing as the difference between boys and girls sports? How did Title IX fundamentally change things, and what have we seen happen in terms of girls sports since Title IX that in many ways mirrors even more closely some of these things that we're talking about?
Well, you know, I think the first thing to be said about Title IX is that its net effect has been enormously positive. That is not in dispute. The number of girls now playing high school sports and rec sports compared to those prior to the enactment of Title IX in 1972, I mean, it's just amazing. So nothing that I say or others say should be interpreted as a criticism of Title IX. That said, you know, many of the less positive aspects of sports for boys now are present in sports for girls because it's become so competitive. All of the issues about, you know, someday attaining a college scholarship and the year-round training and the specialization that are required or that parents perceive is required to get a college scholarship, all of those influences are now present in many girls' sports. That's a negative.
How much misinformation is out there in terms of what, as you alluded to a moment ago, in terms of what parents perceive to be the reality of high school, elementary school, and high school sports, and how is that reality twisted in many cases, in part by the media and the culture?
Well, this is, I think, some of the more interesting reporting in the book, and, you know, constantly surprises me. There's this huge disconnect between what parents think is required to help their kids reach their potential as athletes, and what a pediatrician or a sports medicine expert or what a child psychologist would tell you about this. Big difference. You know, we, as a culture, I think we have come to believe that the Tiger Woods model is the secret. That is the holy grail. You know, start with when your child is in the crib and do not stop until they're on the PGA Tour. And you know, eliminate all distractions, and it's got to be one sport year-round. And what, you know, I've interviewed many physicians about this, and what virtually all of them will tell you is that that's the worst thing you can do. If you want to prevent your kid from reaching their potential as an athlete, follow that model, because kids burn out emotionally. You know, by the time they're 12 or 13, the last thing they want to do is play that sport. Or they break down physically. And, you know, one of the most powerful stats that, you know, I've reported is that 50% of reported injuries among youth athletes in the United States are the result of overuse. They're all of them could be prevented. The only reason they occur is because kids are doing too much, too intensely, and they're starting too young. So, you know, my message to parents is, if you're attempting to help your child reach their potential as an athlete, and I think virtually all of us are, don't follow the Tiger Woods model. You know, maybe one in a million end up like Tiger Woods, but the majority of kids are leaving youth sports because the experience really doesn't suit them as people or developmentally.
It's interesting that no matter how many times those statistics are repeated about what the odds are of becoming a member of the PGA Tour or becoming a professional basketball player or in the NFL, that no matter how many times those long odds are repeated, it seems to make no difference to parents.
Why is that? Well, I have a theory about that. And you know, I have a confession to make, which I actually made in my first book, and that is I've made 95% of the mistakes we're talking about I made with my own children. And, you know, in my first book, I talk about being my coach's youth baseball, my son's youth baseball coach. He came to me after a game. He was pitching. He said, "My arm hurts." And I said to him, "Do you think you could pitch two innings on Thursday?" What what was going through my mind? You know, I was thinking, I'm Casey Stengel. I'm going to coach a team of 12-year-olds to, you know, the world title. And that was such an alarming and self-revelatory experience for me that it kind of set me on this path to start writing books about it. But, you know, the point is that I think we all have the capacity, the potential to lose sight of what's really important. I know I did. And, you know, my son ended up having Tommy John surgery. And that was not because he pushed himself, you know, without my consent or approbation. I would love to see him pitch. Every time he was out there on the mound, I was having a good day. But it wasn't in his interest, and I just couldn't see it at the time.
The broader problem certainly is also the way we view star athletes in our culture today. And that really seems to be the fundamental problem that lies kind of at the heart of all of this.
Well, there's no question that, you know, you get more positive feedback in life being the star of the basketball team than, you know, the star of the biology class. That's just a reality. And I don't think that's ever going to change, and I'm not going to write a book about that because I think that's immutable. We're never going to turn down the volume on the celebrity that surrounds being, you know, the local sports star. What I find troubling is the way that media companies and other for-profit enterprises are leveraging this for their benefit without much thought as to how it's affecting the kids. And, you know, I write about ESPN, not to pick on them again, but they have a national high school basketball championship. It's an unofficial championship, you know, kind of like March Madness, and it's actually played around the time of March Madness. It just ended last week. So I went down to watch this tournament at Georgetown Prep near Washington, D.C., and it's just, you know, it's astonishing to me that they're I could not count the number of Nike swooshes and Gatorade logos, and it was a highly commercial event. It was televised nationally. Was this good for the kids involved? I mean, their seasons had been extended by a month, by a full month, so that they could play in this tournament. For that reason, none of them, if they so chose, could participate in a spring sport because the spring sports were halfway over when this tournament was still being played. And there are many other reasons to question whether, you know, turning kids' sports, and I consider high school sports to be kids' sports, is really in the interest of the kids themselves.
Ultimately, what happens, in your view, if we continue this and, in fact, continue to ratchet it up?
Well, I think it's already happening. You know, our culture values and elevates the most talented kids, right? That's what we want as parents and as consumers of sports. That's what we celebrate. So, and U Sports reflects that. 75% of kids drop out of organized U Sports by the age of 13. 75%. I mean, imagine if you were the CEO of Walmart and 75% of your customers stopped coming to the store. You'd figure something else out. But, you know, youth sports, we don't view youth sports as a lifetime pursuit, as recreation, as a part of a healthy lifestyle. We view it as, you know, how far can the most talented kids take their talents? Can they make it to the college level? And, you know, we were getting what we deserve. There are a class of super talented kids who are achieving at a very high level, and a majority of kids have dropped out. And, you know, we have a national obesity crisis. We have kids who are far less active than they should be. And it's a result of the way we've structured youth sports.
And is that the conclusion that we really need to look at this as kind of a two-tier system, one that is more recreational and one that is more competitive?
Well, yes. I think a two-tier system makes sense. But let's remember that, you know, tier one should be this recreational model because that's what 85 to 95% of kids really are. That's what's in it for them. the percentage of kids who are going on, here's a remarkable stat. 5% of high school seniors playing varsity sports will ever play 1 minute or one down or one inning in college. So the vast majority of kids are just in it for the recreation. And it's odd and I think unfortunate that our model really serves that very tiny fraction who are going to go on and excel at a higher level. But it shouldn't be that way. It should be just the opposite, I think.
And, of course, the other part of it, which we haven't touched on very much, is the degree to which it becomes a feeding system at the high school level for the colleges and the colleges for the pros.
Well, absolutely. I mean, all roads lead to professional sports, or at least that's our expectation as parents. You know, one thing I write about in the book is this enormous business in college recruiting services. This idea that you can hire a company or an individual to help you match up your child with a particular college and, you know, with the possibility of getting a scholarship or in some way benefiting your child. And there's an enormous amount of commerce around this idea. I think people generally are not all that familiar with it, but companies like Nike, for instance, has a training regimen that it calls SPARK. It's an acronym pronounced SPARK. And they go around the country testing kids in four or five skills, compiling, you know, a numerical score that they then supposedly share with college coaches who then, again, supposedly make judgments about who they're going to recruit and offer scholarships to based on these regional testing events. And the reality is that, you know, the coach at USC is not deciding who the quarterback is going to be based on, you know, some local event where a kid ran through four or five tests. But, you know, companies, I think, are making the case to parents that, hey, if you want your kid to be in the hunt and you don't want to disadvantage them relative to other kids on their team, you've got to participate in these kinds of things.
What impact has a tougher economy had on all of this?
Great question. You know, one of the chapters in the book is about travel sports and the extent to which cities and small communities around the country are building these complexes that host travel tournaments. Mm-hmm. So, you know, families will travel several hundred miles sometimes for the weekend to participate in a tournament. And the question you asked came up in the reporting around that. And what I was told is, look, this is the most recession-proof industry around, because parents don't want to deny their children these kinds of opportunities. What they will say is, my daughter is only going to be nine one time. She's only going to have an opportunity to play in this special tournament one time. So we will do without certain things that are we view as discretionary so that we can have this and she can have this experience.
Mark Hyman, the book is The Most Expensive Game in Town, The Rising Cost of Youth Sports and the Toll on Today's Families. It's just out from Beacon Press. Mark, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
That was a great conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.